Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. Today we're talking with John McCaslin, author of Weed Man, The Remarkable Journey of Jimmy Devine. Your book is Weed Man, The Remarkable Journey of Jimmy Devine. Who is Jimmy Devine and what's his story?
His real name is Jimmy Moree. And probably about 3.5, 4 years ago, my younger brother, who lives here in the Washington area, and I invested in a property on a tiny little island in the Bahamas, one of the out islands. It's way out there, called Harbor Island. You have to get to it by boat. It's a quarter mile wide by 3 miles long. There's really no cars on the island. Everybody gets around by bicycle, on foot, or in a golf cart if you choose. And one day, I'm in this little community called Dunmore Town, which is the only town on the island, and the baker on the island who helped us buy our house, which dates 200 years of age plus, came down and he said, I'd like to introduce you to a couple locals here on the island that you know probably would enjoy meeting. And he goes, and they're white Bahamians. The baker is black, and probably about one out of every 30 or 40 Bahamians is white. And so we took a little ride up on his golf cart to the beach, and I met this wonderful couple. His wife was Canadian by birth, and beautiful home, and sat at their kitchen counter and had a couple Mount Gay and sodas. Jimmy doesn't drink. He's a teetotaler, has been all his life, and his wife and I sat there with the baker next to us, Robert Arthur, who, by the way, used to splice tape for Larry King when Larry was starting out in broadcasting in Miami. And I heard the most incredible stories for 2 hours from Jimmy, who became the master of ceremonies, recalling all these wonderful experiences he had growing up in the Bahamas. His family was buccaneers back in the 1700s. They've been down there for obviously over 200 years now, still on the same 500-acre tract on a little island called Long Island that the British Crown gave them for fighting the Spanish. And I said to Jimmy after this 2 hours, it occurred to me that he had never once mentioned what he did for a living to have experienced all these remarkable stories, and he told these stories in a way that he didn't need to, and he finally looked at his wife, and his wife looked at the baker, and the baker looked at me, and on cue I looked back at Jimmy, and in this beautiful, sweet-flowing, conky Joe accent, as they call it, he goes, "Should I tell him?" And that's the beginning of the book. That's my introduction. He did tell me at that point that in his opinion, and I have nobody yet that can step forward and doubt him, that he was probably the biggest drug trafficker, marijuana only, between Colombia and the United States for about a 12-year period up until the early years of the Reagan administration. And he credits Ronald Reagan with putting him out of business, because that's when the law enforcement presence really became visible.
The weed man literally stumbled into his trade, right?
He did at that. He jogged over a bale of marijuana, and there were a total of 40 that eventually washed in. And if you think, well, that's very unusual, how could that be? It's very common that a lot of drug traffickers will drop a load for whatever reason, whether they're about to be busted or it was agreed upon, because bales of marijuana will last in the water for a while. The day Barack Obama was inaugurated, in fact, just a few months ago, bales were floating up to shore right on Harbor Island, where my house is. But anyway, long story short, he went to this policeman on the island, the only policeman on the island, named Sarge, and he said, "What are we going to do with this marijuana that I think floated up?" And the Sarge looked at him, totally an answer Jimmy didn't expect, because Jimmy's never done drugs, he doesn't drink. And the Sarge says, "Do you know who might want to buy it?" Jimmy couldn't believe it. They loaded all the marijuana into these two of Jeep and into a pickup truck. It took several runs for the truck. Took the marijuana to the jail in this little town and stored it in the jail. And at that point, Jimmy flew back to Nassau, where his aunt and uncle still lived, and he talked to the only guy he knew that he suspected was dealing drugs, and that was a guy he knew from growing up, also a white Bahamian who was educated in Europe. And sure enough, he came over and grabbed the marijuana from them. He sold it and came back about a week or so, about 10 days later, with a duffel bag containing, as Jimmy says, all these American dead presidents. And that was the beginning of a relationship. He and the chief, he called him. I don't want to identify him. He's now deceased. That went on for 12 years.
And he became the largest marijuana dealer, basically, in the United States, or moving from Colombia to the U.S. Mm-hmm. He was philanthropic to the locals.
Jimmy worked out of several islands in terms of bringing the marijuana from Colombia through the Bahamas into the United States. Many of the locals knew what he was doing. They worked alongside him. Even the prime minister back then, you'll remember, as we got into the cocaine years, was charged. He never left office with taking care of one of the biggest cocaine dealers, who was based in one of the islands not far from Harbor Island today. Apparently paid up to $70,000, $80,000 a month to turn and look the other way. So there was a lot of collusion going on. Everybody knew what Jimmy was doing, but nobody turned him in, nor did they turn anybody else.
But he ended up serving time in two federal prisons.
Jimmy was eventually indicted around 1982 by Uncle Sam. He had already been retired for a couple years. He came back to do one drug run for the chief before the chief died. His buddy was still living in Fort Lauderdale. By the way, this compound that they owned in Fort Lauderdale, where they at least were based when they brought a lot of the drugs in, the only time they ever stored marijuana in these three houses was if there was an overflow and they couldn't get rid of it. But it was incredible what they did, how smart the chief was. The second they bought these three homes, they called up the Fort Lauderdale Police Department and they started the Crime Watch program for their area. So the police came over and stuck three signs in each of the houses. This is protected by Neighborhood Crime Watch. And they were never suspected of doing anything beyond that.
And how long did he actually serve in?
He was sentenced to 5 years. Most people that did what he did would have served dozens of years, and never gotten out until they had done that time. Jimmy became a government informant after he was indicted. He had done a run that I propose in the book was done for the CIA. He came out of retirement to do it. Jimmy never brought marijuana any further north than West Palm Beach. For this case, he brought in thousands of pounds of hashish that was taken off of a sailing sloop 200 miles off the Virginia coast into near Williamsburg, Virginia. Three vans pulled up, dark blue color, looked very government to him. Jimmy said, for all I know, these 12 guys that jumped out of them were baseball players, but he said they looked military, they looked intelligence, I don't know who they were. Very little eye contact. They unloaded three boatloads that Jimmy brought in of hashish, and it was brought north, where I can't exactly say, but some of it ended up in Middleburg, Virginia, and some in Massachusetts, which is where he was indicted from.
Right.
And because of the fact Jimmy turned in a lot of the big coke guys, he hated cocaine, it killed the chief, who became addicted to it. Jimmy always despised that and most drugs, and does to this day, even though he trafficked it.
You have covered D.C. for decades for the Washington Times and other publications. Is this a city of hypocrites when it comes to drug use?
By all means. I know plenty of people in Washington, D.C. that smoke marijuana to this day, including in our own industry, and then go on and anchor the news. And I'm not naming any names, but it's very common, so I think it is.
Is D.C. catching up with the American population in terms of becoming less hypocritical about drug policy? Under Obama, is drug legalization or marijuana legalization in the offing?
Yes. Well, there's actually a House bill right now that was introduced, by Barney Frank. Now, guess who two of the co-sponsors are? Dana Rohrabacher, an old Reaganite from California, and Ron Paul, the former presidential candidate and Republican from Texas. So what they want it decriminalized and taken away from the feds, where if you have 3.5 ounces of marijuana, which is a pretty good stash of marijuana, if you have 3.5 ounces or left on your person, the federal government can't do anything to you. Let the states deal with it. It would be a way to decriminalize. And at the same time, in tandem, we've got the decriminalization of marijuana for medicinal use. And they're finding out the wonders of that drug for somebody that has had cataract surgery or is suffering from chemotherapy symptoms. So I think it is. I think Washington is catching up. You just have to look at the popularity and the insatiable appetite that Americans do obviously have for it, because of it's one of the most profitable crops in the country right now. Even though grown illegally, it's everywhere. And then you've got even places to our north, like in Vancouver, it's the biggest crop that's grown there.
Thank you very
much. Thank you. Appreciate it, Nick.
We've been talking with John McCaslin, the author of Weed Man, The Remarkable Journey of Jimmy Devine.